Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Harris. Mr. Handelson.
May it please the court, Robert Handelsman for the appellant. I'll approach the issues in the order in which they're raised in the briefs. First issue is sufficiency. Harris worked the night shift and slept during the day. The police found her topless in her bedroom doorway when she had small children in the house. And women don't go topless when there are small children around. The drug paraphernalia in the kitchen doesn't show guilt. Could have been taken out when Harris went to bed. The drug residue in the garbage doesn't show guilt because it could have been placed there when she was working at night or asleep during the day. There is no evidence that crack gives off an odor when it is being cooked up. And if Harris was a sound sleeper, she would not have known of the crack in the bedroom. And the Officer Wise testified it does not take very long to cook up crack in a microwave. The most damaging evidence against Harris is the discrepancy between what she told the officers about how long she was in the bedroom and what Riley said as to how long she was in the bedroom. But look at Harris's condition when the police came in, topless, tired, and very nervous and frightened. If she didn't say anything to the officers, there probably wouldn't have been enough to take this case to trial. We realize that the inferences from the evidence are the jury's responsibility. But at some point, you have to say that circumstantial evidence and the inferences from it can go just so far. And this is just such a case.
Whose apartment was this?
It was her house.
Her house, not the boyfriend's?
No. He stayed there off and on.
Did she own or did she rent?
She owned it. I think in his testimony, he said he stayed there more off than on, but
there was evidence, was there not, sir, of drugs or drug industry throughout that home, or through at least a good portion of the living space?
I don't think so, Your Honor. As I recall the testimony...
Where'd they find the weapons?
They found two guns, one up on a headboard and one hidden in a... I think it was a linen cabinet in the basement, or it was outside. I don't recall exactly where the linen cabinet was. Mm-hmm. There were two guns found. Riley said she didn't know they were there.
You mentioned that she said something. What did she say that was...
She said both officers testified that she said she had just gone into the bedroom. Riley said she was sleeping.
Did you say there wasn't evidence of drug paraphernalia in the house?
There was, in the kitchen, whatever Riley used to cook up crack was
there
in
was
the kitchen.
Plastic Ziploc baggies, a coat hanger laced with crack?
Yes.
A digital scale? A microwave in the kitchen cabinet loaded with the fruiter, all of this cash around? What was it?
Riley said it was a church gathering
or something?
No, I'm not saying that it was. It doesn't take long to cook up crack. If she was in the
bedroom... I'm not experienced with that.
Well, the officer testified to that. He said, I don't recall the page of his testimony. He said, it doesn't take very long to cook up crack. She had been in a bedroom for a half an hour, that stuff could have gone out there. And she wouldn't have known about it.
What are the ages of the children? Do we know the ages?
I don't recall if the records show their ages. I think the officer testified they were small children.
Would you suggest that, suppose they were teenagers, just for the sake of discussion, that the mother's involvement or the inferences one could draw from that are no greater than if there were two 18-year-olds in the house? I mean, are you suggesting she just happens to own it and she's kind of victimized by who she keeps company with?
I think there was a stronger inference of that than her actual knowledge. I mean, from her perspective, obviously, obviously the evidence doesn't look good.
No, I understand. But the number of things in plain sight, I guess, give me some pause. I appreciate the thrust of your argument, but the gun is in plain sight, is it not?
The officer said he found it on a headboard. I don't recall if he said it was behind something or if it was readily anybody could see it walking in. He may have said, now, I don't want you to quote me on this because it's been a while since I looked at it. I think he said, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe it was in a linen closet, he had to feel around to find it. I am not sure which one he said he had to feel around to find. He may have said he had to feel around, find the one on the headboard, and he found the one in the towel cabinet under some towels. I am not sure about that.
A loaded gun, too.
Pardon me?
A loaded gun.
Well, drug dealers have loaded guns.
Oh, I thought you...
No. She could very... There's a strong inference here that she is a victim of circumstances. And these things happen. We know they happen. And that's why I'm asking you to take a hard look at this record. On this. To see if which way the inferences point stronger to her being a victim of circumstances or she knew. Now, she knew, obviously, but... You know, we see a lot of drug cases here, and in this one, the evidence certainly isn't as strong as we see in most of the drug cases we get. And that hearsay 404B evidence didn't help the situation either. I can't imagine this prosecutor didn't go over the questions with the officer before he testified.
That's perhaps a good prosecutorial work, isn't it?
Well, I think most lawyers do before they put a witness on. Here are the questions. How are you going to answer them? That evidence shouldn't have been in there. And in a weak case like this, or marginal case, I should say, it can certainly push the jury over. As to argument three, our two briefs point out the similarities between NSF check convictions and shoplifting convictions. And the government's brief points out the distinctions. The similarities outweigh the distinctions. As a practical matter, as far as a store owner is concerned, there's no difference between shoplifting and using NSF checks. Now, in the Boyd case, the panel here held that an uninsured motorist conviction is like driving on a suspended license, and certainly shoplifting is a lot more like using NSF checks than an uninsured motorist conviction is similar to driving on a suspended license.
But there are situations, because banks, financial institutions, for example, charge, as you know, Mr. Hamilton.
Yeah, they do.
Charge for having such a check. So in the galaxy of transactions, the NFS check situation does envision some innocent conduct, I should say. Is it not true that in the shoplifting situation, there is no such comparable?
There is. An insurance company might have to pay the store owner for the merchandise that's paid for with rubber checks.
Well, but what I'm suggesting is there can be potential for an innocent construction on a situation when I should just say it. Rather than, how do we ever get an innocent construction of the conduct of the actor in a shoplifting situation?
Well, as far as that goes, the Indiana statute here, and there's a reference to it in the briefs, if the check writer makes a check good, then there's no prosecution because that nullifies the mens rea contention. Other than that, well...
On the 404B, you argue there should have been a mistrial.
Yes.
Was there, but he didn't call...
He just objected. Judge struck the evidence, told the jury to disregard it. If this was a strong case and there was no sufficiency argument, this wouldn't have been brought up. But because this is an extremely marginal case, and as I mentioned before, compared to the drug cases, we see... The evidence here was a lot thinner than it usually is. For that reason, I'm raising this argument. If the evidence was overwhelming, wouldn't be mentioning it.
She isn't the most honest person either, is she?
Pardon me?
Your client isn't the most honest person.
Well, she didn't testify, so the...
How about what she told the officers as to how long she had known her co-defendant?
Look at her situation.
No,
she's nervous.
She answered. She said a year, didn't she?
Yeah, she said a year.
She had a 4-year-old child with him.
Yes. That doesn't show that somebody is guilty.
No, but it just shows that she's not the most reliable, credible witness.
She didn't testify.
I'm talking about what she said at the time
of
the
investigation. Okay, but look at the circumstances here. I'd just like to say one last point on the NSF check issue. The two out-of-circuit cases are no help here. Neither involved a comparison of shoplifting with NSF checks. I think Boyd would allow you to say that shoplifting convictions are substantively and as a practical matter the same as an NSF check conviction. On the last issue, I will rest on the brief.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Mr. Bella?
Good morning, Your Honors. I am neither the attorney who tried the case for the government nor the attorney who wrote the brief.
So you didn't prepare the officer for...
No, Your Honor. Andrew Baker from our office prepared the brief in this case. And
Baker's unavailable for argument?
Yes, he's due to health reasons. So I am arguing the case for the government on his behalf.
Understood. Since we're on the subject, that really does look like this question of the elicitation of 404B evidence really does look like a setup, unless this is particularly Assistant United States Attorney who is trying this case didn't do the usual prep of the case agent.
Well, Mr. Baker in the brief suggests that the answer that the Assistant U.S. Attorney may have expected was the Assistant U.S. Attorney had just asked the officer about why he arrested the defendant, and he responded it was due to the physical evidence. And I think this was on redirect, so it was in response to something that was brought up on cross. And the officer said it was because of the physical evidence at the scene. And in the brief, Mr. Baker suggested the Assistant United States Attorney, when asking the follow-up question, was there anything else, expected the officer to refer to the lies that were given to the police officers at the scene by Barbara Harris.
How much did they really add to the equation? Was that really what he was looking for?
Well, I can't, unfortunately, I can't speak
I
for the
Assistant
U.S.
You're
Attorney,
right.
But I think it very well
situation.
I think it very well could have been, because once that issue is injected into the trial in front of the jury, and again, I say this was redirect in response to something that occurred on cross, then the prosecutor trying the case wants to get all that out in front of the jury again, all the circumstances which would incriminate the defendant, not only the physical evidence but also the lies.
There's also the possibility that was the intent of the Assistant United States Attorney, and the case agent decided to take a shot.
I would hope it was not the intent of the Assistant United States Attorney. It could be that the case agent decided to do that. It also could be that the case agent just didn't know where she was going with her question. It's an open-ended question. Was there anything else?
Well, if the question is dealing with the decision to arrest, I think we could all agree, perhaps even Mr. Hamilton, for the purpose of an arrest, the physical evidence was enough, right?
Yes.
Why would you? I mean, that's a 100%. Answer. We don't have a warrant situation. We don't have a bond situation here.
I view that sequence of questions and answers as an attempt to parade before the jury once again the admissible evidence against the defendant. First of all, the physical evidence. Secondly, the defendant's lies. I view the open-ended question as a dangerous question because you don't know what your witness is going to come back with.
Well, that's for sure, because that really, if she is a conduit to the street, so to speak, you know, someone who aids in delivery, that really cements this and would make it, if admissible, not the arguably close case Mr. Hamilton posits. You know, I mean, that really does push it pretty close, doesn't it? I mean, it'd be pretty hard to eradicate that thought.
I don't think that it was an open-ended question. I don't think it was a question that was leading the witness into what the witness said.
Well, it may also be troubling if the government was possessed of knowledge, which I don't know that they were, that the defendant was not going to take the stand.
I think
that decision may not have, there's no requirement that the defense at this point in time tell, you know, the government. But if the government were possessed, I'm just speaking in hypothetical terms, that would put a slightly more onerous spin on the situation.
I think we're inferring too much about the intent of the assistant U.S. attorney here.
Well, I'm just taking it from the words.
Possibly,
but you can see what can trouble a court here.
Yes.
In a case that
if this were a deliberate ploy, or this were a staged, pre-planned question and answer, I would share the court's concern. I don't see that from the transcript here.
Is there anywhere in the record that would bolster, for example, the agent's assessment in this response that indeed he had evidence of Harris's delivery of cocaine for Riley? I had information, and that certainly could be just street information. But do you know if the record would?
I don't know of anything in the record that would show that. I'm not as familiar with the record as I otherwise would be. But I don't.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
The briefs don't refer to anything of that sort. I think that the transcript on that issue leaves very open the innocent explanation of that question and answer. And as I said, I'd share the court's concern if there was something to indicate that this was staged. I don't think the transcript shows that. I think the government's brief suggests that the assistant U.S. attorney expected a different answer from this officer.
The presiding judge at no point indicated that he thought this was a deliberate attempt.
No. And this is a very short question and answer in the record. There's no indication that there was any other kind of mugging business or shenanigans in the record, and the judge granted the objection, admonished the jury, and that was the end of it. I think that was the appropriate.
Yeah, I guess it bothers me, Mr. Bellows, so to the extent that it's ingrained in whatever reflections you or the office want to have on this matter, is if she was evasive in her responses, which may have occurred, or the conclusion of the agent that she wasn't forthcoming, and that kind of just cemented it on top of the physical evidence. But there's no innocent construction of delivering cocaine, whether it's for Riley or anyone else. So maybe this is an inexperienced agent, but this is clearly referenced to other criminal conduct. And in this case, criminal conduct that really, locks in what was found. And that's my concern.
In responding to the court's concern, I certainly don't mean to indicate that as an office we wouldn't take something like that
very seriously. And you have a very experienced trial judge here, so I appreciate, and I think it's a good point that my colleague makes, and obviously defense counsel, while recognizing objectionable the question and answer, didn't at that moment feel it's imperative to call for a mistrial. So
the court's concern is well taken, and I will share that concern with trial counsel. I would take what the court is suggesting as perhaps the more sinister and possible explanation. I would take that very seriously.
Yeah, no, I think speaking to a comment that Judge Coffey made, there's absolutely nothing wrong in the preparation. In fact, one would wonder if an assistant didn't go over with an agent. I guess the difficulty is if the assistant didn't go over with the agent, then that has its own problems. But I'm not in the executive branch; I'm in the third branch. And if it is extensive preparation, then a lot of problems can happen. I don't want to chew into your time, but I think it is of, enough of a moment that whether it impacts the outcome of this case or not, that we were appropriately taking notice, and I appreciate your sensitivity on the matter too.
Thank you. And having read enough transcripts and seen a number of these cases, as we all have, I can see where an open-ended question like that can lead to testimony that's unexpected, and that's why I say that can be dangerous. As I said, I'll share those concerns. I think that the transcript here admits a completely innocent explanation that was made by Mr. Baker in the brief. Turning to the evidence in the case, I think is overwhelming. There are drugs all over the house. The drugs in the bedroom, the fan deliberately aimed, set up. The fan was set up in the bedroom and angled in such a way to aim at the drugs to cool them down. There was a scale and stir stick in the kitchen. There were a gun in the bedroom, a gun in the basement area. There were baggies in the kitchen for packaging the drugs. This wasn't a one-time occurrence either. There were paraphernalia in the garbage before, $21,000 of cash in the bedroom. Not only the defendant scantily clothed, but also Riley scantily clothed. I think that indicates they were there together.
Ms. Harris works, right?
Yeah.
What did she do? Do we know?
I don't recall what she did, but she worked a shift, I think, that went from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m.
And what about Riley? What's his personal history as far as employment?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. This was, I think, about 1:30 in the afternoon. So... Mm-hmm.
We do have a situation also of I was wondering whether Riley is committed to employment other than drugs, and it is interesting that she's a working woman with small children. I mean, if she was really a handmaiden or partner with Riley, unless it's a great cover or an extraordinary job she has, the fact that she works a shift doesn't, I think, add to the circumstances. Do you think that supports in any way Mr. Handelson's description of her
No.
being victimized by her companion?
No, I don't. I think Barbara Harris's entire history shows disrespect for the law, uncaring behavior, and I think the bottom line here is the evidence here should be considered the light most favorable to the government, and there's more than sufficient evidence to support the conviction. I have limited time left. Turning to the criminal history. The Ninth Circuit case cited indicates that Guideline Section 4A1.1C1 is a rule of inclusion, not a rule of exclusion. That is, misdemeanors and minor offenses should be included unless they're on that list. And even if they're on that list, if there's a sentence of 30 days in jail or a year probation, they're included. The offenses of shoplifting or conversion and not sufficient funds checks are not similar. There's a trespassory taking in a shoplifting or conversion. It's a lesser included offense of theft. They're punished under separate statutes in the state of Indiana. And even if you look at the insufficient fund check situation under the guidelines, not all insufficient fund checks cases are excluded. If there's the use of a false name or a non-existent account, they are included. So even the guidelines limit that exclusion of NSF check cases. And I don't know how you'd analogize that to shoplifting. I guess if you carry out merchandise in plain view, maybe it's excluded, or if you hide the merchandise when you carry it out, it's included. That just kind of shows the ridiculous nature of trying to compare the two offenses. They're separate offenses.
Your position is, I assume in part, that since shoplifting is such a well-known offense, whatever its level of, in the eyes of this particular legislature, as far as felonious aspect, commentary should have dealt with this.
Exactly. That was my next
point. The elephant in the room that they should have recognized it, or would have recognized is that it, and they didn't. So.
Yes. You would think that if the commission wanted to exclude petty larceny or shoplifting, they would have specifically listed them as one of these offenses, and they did not. Unless there are any other questions.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bella. Mr. Handelson?
I think the last comment from counsel was what the commission would have included. Well, we can go back to the Boyd case. If the commission wanted to say that driving without insurance is the same as driving on a suspended license, they would have said so. But this court drew the analogy, and the court can take the same reasoning that was used in Boyd and say that an NSF check conviction without more is no different than a shoplifting conviction. Counsel mentioned something about Harris. He said her entire history. If my recollection serves me correct, I didn't check the PSR before I came in here, but I don't believe she has any other drug convictions. I could be wrong on that, but best of my recollection, she didn't have any other drug convictions. Shoplifting is not in the same category as possession with intent to distribute. The cross-examination of Officer Wise about what he found is on pages 140, 141 of the transcript. The assistant was certainly within her rights to ask about this question. The decision was based on the physical evidence that was found in the home. And he said yes. I mean, what else was she expecting to get with the anything else? This was not broad. The door was not open on cross. And unfortunately,
there wasn't anything on regarding what her responses were during that exchange that would have allowed for that. I don't know.
I mean, people get arrested all the time and they don't tell 100% truth. They pull somebody in DWI. Were you drinking? No, I wasn't drinking. I mean, these things happen all the time. If the officers don't base arrest just on maybe something that someone said, they're looking for the physical evidence. She said the physical evidence was probably enough for probable cause here. But to go into it, there was no reason for it.
What about the impression that was left with the defense counsel, who chose only to appropriately call for it being stricken, but not for seeing it of the dimension requiring a mistrial?
That's a good point, but, you know, counsel, you know, sitting at a table, you know, so many things going through his mind, his client jabbering at him, and he probably acted just reflexively without, you don't have the time to sit down and think, well, the ramifications of this and ramifications of that, it's an instantaneous thing. I'd just like to leave you with one thought, if I could. If Riley was happening to tell the truth here, and he could very well be, an innocent person here was convicted. Because we can see a situation from this record, if she had been in that bedroom for 45 minutes, she may very well not have known what was going on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Thank you, Isabella. Mr. Hamilton, a special thanks to the court to you for accepting and ably representing Ms. Harris.
Thank you.
Thank you.